Well, it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, my hometown, up on the edge of the prairie. It's been a cold, wet spring so far, but we have our experts and our consultants at work on it, and they're getting a hold of the situation and gradually turning it. And so we're expecting it to warm up soon. The fields are already plowed and harrowed, many of them. Still some corn stubble in some from last year, but ready for seed and ready for heat. And in the Chatterbox Cafe, old men sit and carry on the same conversations they did when I was 16, 17 years old enough to pay attention to them, talking about the weather and about planting and about fishing and how the crappies don't seem to be going for minnows now, but they heard that somebody got a few with a spinner and didn't think that was possible, but maybe it was. And pretty soon the sunfish will be biting. And you know, these little fish are pretty good eaters, and they're good enough until walleye season comes along. And I listened to them in the cafe, and I remember why it was I went to the University of Minnesota. It was so I wouldn't grow up to be those old men and carry on those small circular conversations that avoided anything too interesting or anything emotional. I arrived here in late September 1960 as an entering freshman, and the night before I started classes, I rode a Greyhound bus up to Isle, Minnesota, where my Uncle Lawrence had a Ford dealership to pick up a car, which was part of the deal, my coming to the university. My parents insisted that I live at home for the first year, so that if I showed signs of degeneracy, they could try to help me. I rode the Greyhound bus north. It was a Sunday night. There was heavy oncoming traffic. The sun went down. I sat on the left side of the bus about halfway back. There were very few passengers. I had my reading light on. I was reading Thoreau's Walden, which was a big book to me when I was 18. And somewhere near Malacca, a station wagon heading south passed a whole long line of cars and swung back into line and swung too far, and his right tire caught on the right side of the pavement of that narrow two-lane concrete highway. And he had to pull it up off the trough, and he pulled it too far, and he pulled into our lane, and he collided head-on with the bus. I felt the bus rock, and I was standing up, standing against the seats right in front of me as it tipped way over and went down into the ditch and up into the field and came to a stop. I walked off the bus, forced the door open, walked out into a field that smelled so sweet of hay. There were crickets. It was dark. There were headlights extending both ways on the highway, all the way to the horizon. I walked back to the highway, which was littered with broken glass, and in the light from the headlights, I could see three bodies on the concrete. They were still. They were dead. And another, a young man, bare-chested, in the back of the station wagon, his head at an odd angle, his neck broken, a Catholic priest leaning over him, praying. And the next morning I was here. On a beautiful day, the sun shining, walking up over the footbridges, arching over Washington Avenue and coming up the mall. Back before mall came to mean something else, it meant this: a long, formal approach to a university campus with parallel walks and hedges and crosswalks dividing rectangles of lawn and a parade of stately buildings on either side. Actually, ordinary brick buildings, but with concrete pillars glued to the fronts of them to give the place some grandeur, because after all, this was a place where a young person came to learn words like dichotomy and epistemology and to learn to use them all in one sentence. The dichotomization of epistemology. I walked up through this river of humanity, of studentry, such interesting people, you could sit and watch them for hours, and I sometimes did. Some who looked like college students and dressed in nice sweaters and plaids, and boys wearing loafers, and stunning women with their books pressed against their breasts. And when I was 18, every woman was remarkable to me in some way. There were still veterans here studying on the GI Bill, dressed in grungy clothes, Army, Navy, surplus. And there were foreign students, Nigerians and Ghanaians and Kenyans, some as black could be, in native outfits. They were stunning to look at. And Indians, Indian women in saris and Pakistanis. And a lot of people like me, sort of nicely dressed in cheap clothes, trying to pass, trying to be pleasant. Walked up the walk, past chemistry and past Walter Library and Johnston Hall and Northrop up on the hill, this great temple of an auditorium with its great inscription on the front about the ennoblement of man through learning and the advancement of learning and the search for truth. And around the side of Northrop and past Westbrook and Nicholson and across the street and past Jones Hall and up to that long German castle, Falwell Hall, where my first class was, Composition 27. There were about 30 students. Richard Cody was the instructor. He was an Englishman with red hair. He stood behind a table on a raised platform. The rest of us sat at little chairs with arm pads for writing at. There was a smell of smoke in the air and a lot of people smoking little tuna fish cans for ashtrays, a stuffy room in the fall. And he told us that our first composition would be due on Friday, 750 words on a personal experience. Well, I had just had a personal experience, so I would write about that. At the end of the class, we all stood up and I suddenly blacked out and fell lengthwise across chairs. I knocked a couple out of the way and I bounced off a third and landed on the floor and came to. And I realized people were standing around me, looking down at me. And it occurred to me that they were writers, as I was, and had never seen a man fall like this. And they were saving this up. And they would use this sometime. I would fall again in their stories. Maybe I'd be shot the next time. I felt so privileged to be at the university. It was an immense campus, 50-some thousand students, and yet all of my classes were small that first quarter. My Latin reading class with Margaret Forbes was 15 students, and my humanities class with James Wright was no more than about 40. I felt so privileged to be here in this world of books and libraries and writers, and at the same time afraid that I would be thrown out and would have to get a job working for the post office sorting mail. Not that this fear made me work harder as a student, it didn't. I was a fitful student, but I came here to get a life and to be a writer. And I had an idea that I could do that here. It was a very different university then than it is now. For one thing, you could work your way through school back then when tuition was $80 for a quarter and the part-time wage was $1.50. You could pay for your tuition and books and even pay for a share of an apartment working part-time. I worked as a parking lot attendant when I arrived at about a 10-acre lot high on the west bank bluff of the Mississippi River, where classroom buildings are now. Went there at 6 o'clock every morning and worked a 3-hour shift before classes. A good job. The lot filled up quickly, and you learned how to do your job right, and you learned the importance of using power for the common good. You stood in the dark in a place where the headlights of incoming cars could pick you up after they had paid admission, and you directed them to the one right place where they must park. You had to park them in a gravel lot. There were no lines. You had to park them in straight lines so that the lot could receive its maximum capacity of cars. And your lines had to include those orphan cars, those gypsies who had come in the middle of the night and were parked at odd places. And if anybody tried to veer off and follow their own instinct and go down that way, you had to go get them and convince them that they had to park in this one place. Western civilization depended on their coming to this place and parking here. It was a good thing for a young person to learn to do. I worked here washing dishes in the scullery and the dormitories, and later I worked editing a literary magazine and writing for it and for the school paper, and I started in radio here at the university. I started in my freshman year working for the student radio station in Kauffman Union, which broadcast by an odd method. I couldn't understand quite the technology of it, but you broadcast by closed circuit to the dormitories only, using the electrical systems of those buildings as a kind of antenna. I went to work there and I did a 15-minute newscast every day, worked an hour or two editing it from AP wire copy. I interviewed poets and writers and did a couple of taped documentaries. And then, towards spring of that year, a man from the union staff came to explain to me that there was some technical problem, a problem with the hookup, which meant that we hadn't been heard outside of the studios for a long time, probably a year, maybe two. It didn't faze me in the least. It only made me want to go into radio even more. If it were so much fun to do radio, think how much more fun it would be if you had listeners, I felt. It was like the poem by Emily Dickinson, "Success is counted sweetest by those who ne'er succeed. To comprehend a nectar requires sorest need. Not one of all the purple host who took the flag today can tell the definition so clear of victory as he defeated dying on whose forbidden ear the distant sounds of triumph burst agonized and clear." That was me. Defeated, not dying, but sometimes close to it. Defeated. I'd never experienced triumph here, but I could hear it. Concerts were so cheap to go to, even on a parking lot attendant salary. You could come down here to Northrop Auditorium, and I did see the Royal Danish Ballet and Arthur Rubinstein play, and once saw Andres Segovia all alone on this stage in front of 4,700 people play an unamplified guitar. I came here and saw Robert Frost, who filled this building in 1961 and who read his poem, "Some Say the World Will End in Fire, Some Say in Ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice." Elegance was what we craved. Elegance as students at the university, wanting to be writers. We came to the university from families of large, taciturn people who sat quietly around the dinner table chewing their jello. We came in from small towns into the University of Minnesota. And the thing that worried us was, what if we're not good enough? What if we're not cool enough to be here? To be cool has always been a problem for Minnesotans. We're never quite as cool as we'd like to be. Envy is the first sin that we master in Minnesota. Envy. And then gluttony. Some people get around to lust, not everybody. Anger, sloth are off in the distance, but envy. Envy that we're not quite as good as people on the coasts. That this way that we have our hair, this outfit we're wearing, this is a look that was over a long time ago in New York and Los Angeles. We're not quite cool enough. But the university cures you of envy by engaging you in scholarship and a search for truth, whereby you find out things you didn't know existed. And you sit in close quarters, elbow to elbow with other people. You're not as prepared as you would like to be, and nonetheless, flares go off. Whole landscapes are illuminated for you in classrooms. And you learn to see through sophistication. That is education that only teaches people a set of manners. You go far beyond it to discover something that is far better, thrilled by that feeling of being a colleague with a professor and being in a common enterprise. But the great flare that illuminated my landscape took place 30 years ago this week at the university as I was getting ready to leave it. I was a graduate student. I worked at a job that I hated. I had met my wife at the university. She was a music major studying the organ. We sat in a basement practice room at Scott Hall. I studied, she practiced. We were expecting a child that spring, and the baby came at University Hospital on the third floor. We were students. We went to University Hospital. It was a teaching hospital. It was cheap to go to because we were the lesson. She sat, she lay in the labor room, and ever so often a group of 10 or 12 medical students would come in and study her, and there would be a lecture. She was in labor for 48 hours to bring this child about. I sat, I slept in the room there, I listened to her calling and screaming. Her doctor was a Spanish man, he was a good man. She said to me, after 48 hours, she said, if I don't make it, and she started to cry. I found the doctor who was by the nursing station. He was reading an obstetrics textbook. I said, I think it's time to do this now. I don't think it'll get easier as we wait. He agreed. He took her into the delivery room. I could have gone. I didn't think I could bear if the worst should happen. I thought I could be of more use walking the campus and praying, which I did. I said to God, there's only one thing I ask, and this is it. And it was the only thing. I walked among people who were carrying on their lives. I was so amazed that people still could with all of this happening to me. It was twilight. I walked up past Walter Library. I walked all the way around this campus. I thought to myself, your life will never, ever be the same. I came back to the hospital just as the pediatrician carried this little boy out. He was so beautiful, even though he looked as if he'd been in a boxing match. He had a light of intelligence in his eyes. I held him for just a moment. And right then was where my childhood ended, when your own child appears. The next week, I quit the job that I hated. I buckled down and I wrote some stories and sent them to a magazine out east, and they bought one that summer. And that's my story. I came here to find a life. I found it. I became a writer here. I got a child here. I'm so grateful. That's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong. All the men are good looking. All the children are above average.